I'm probably gonna knock that over, but I gotta at least try. Whoops. So I'm just now entering the realm of people who use an iPad for an event. We'll see how that goes. Thanks everybody for coming and for inviting me, Erica, and the Park Service for inviting me to be part of this. It's an honor to read with thoughtful people about this. I, too, like Erica, that's not a good idea, was invited to be part of this by Jay on behalf of the Park Service, and I thought, oh, that sounds like a great idea in general, and if someone in your neighborhood asks you to contribute to something and tells you that they'll pay you for it, you should say yes, just for the record. Plus, it seemed like a great project, and when I was told about the conceit of it, where different writers would write about a different aspect of climate change, I was like, ooh, I hope I get the glaciers. And I'm really glad I didn't. When I was assigned wetlands, my first thought was, that's going to be kind of dry. I really did think that. And it isn't something I would have naturally gravitated toward, but I was really grateful for the opportunity to kind of muck around in a topic that I wouldn't have been drawn to on my own. So, yeah, it's kind of an interesting byproduct of the process. So I'm going to read, mine is also quite long, and I'm going to read from the beginning, and then I'll skip through. There's quite a lot in here about wetlands and also about sandhill cranes, which became my avenue into talking about wetlands. I did a lot of research with Park Service folks, Carol McIntyre and Amy, gosh, I just forgot her last name, Amy Davis. I talked to both of them at some length, and there's a lot more about that end of things in the piece online. I'm not going to read from the more research-heavy climate modeling and some botany and stuff right now, but I'll skim through those pieces, and hopefully what I've chosen to read will kind of hang together on its own. The title of the piece is Crane Water Change, a Migratory Essay. And it begins with a section called Neighbors. Near the end of August, I wait for the first sound. Usually it comes from a few birds too high to see clearly. Not flocks, not yet. Gradually it builds, the number, the sound, through early September until it crescendos in the third week with a raucous noise that vaults past beautiful. Sandhill cranes on the move are startling and epic. They remind me that wildness is not always silent. By early October, the numbers thin, lessening again until there are just a few birds too high to see clearly, migrations parentheses. The last cranes leave as snow comes to say, stay. Hurry, guys, I cheer them on from the front porch as Arctic storms move in from the nesting grounds they've just left behind. It's getting cold. Go, go, go. The first time I saw sandhill cranes in mass, I lived further south on Prince William Sound, and though notable flocks flowed overhead in spring, they were so intermingled with every other noisy bird that passes through the Copper River coastal plain, it was hard to focus on cranes alone. Now I live just outside of the town of Healy in Alaska's interior, abutting Denali's northern border, and sandhills pass right over the roof. In our arid, empty sky, cranes are the stars. Some mornings they fly directly above the skylight over my bed, the first living things I see when I open my eyes. My neighborhood is knit by sounds: mosquitoes, engines, birdsong, wind. This is rural living, each of us seeking quiet privacy on our own 2 acres or 20. But at the edge of taiga forest, stunted black spruce and tundra plants do not muffle the way a denser forest does, and we live amidst each other's daily noise. Howls from the north mean Jared is hooking up the dog team. A nail gun early is Jess at her rafters, hoping to be weathered in before the first snow. Neighbor kids shout and fire BB guns too close. Approaching tires on the gravel road say truck or station wagon, local commute or tourist drive-by, trailer or dump truck or ATV. We add our voices, stopped in the middle of the road with our car doors open to talk, or short honks, or a lifted finger from the wheel in the quietest local hello. This neighborhood is a subdivision, which makes it a home for us, but it's also woven through with wetlands, which makes it a home for birds. Just up the road is 8 Mile Lake, bold and saturated muskeg, and in springtime, Pangini Creek tributaries flow loud enough to hear even over the sounds of a chainsaw and drifting top 40 from seasonals too new to know how much we can hear. Resident birds offer up their sounds with ours all year long, a great horned owl pair hooting in the aspen grove, loudest in May, and the magpies, tricky ventriloquists, hollering in every voice but human. Ravens dip into the dog's bowl and crow about the soggy kibbles they find floating there. In spring, migratory birds join the cacophony. Robins drink from puddles and sing bright orange songs, novel after winter's limited palate hush. And cranes pour overhead in coursing V's. "Welcome back," I shout from the porch. In the fall, at the close of a busy summer not prone to stand still, the humans pause and talk to each other at length. An annual harvest party has sprung up in our neighborhood. 4 years running now, it is a tradition I look forward to. The first weekend in September, we gather to share local food and discuss the past months. We make a table out of sawhorses and 2x10s and load it with all the Alaska food you can imagine. Moose backstrap and flounder ceviche, 3 kinds of smoked salmon, sauerkraut and sourdough bread, and beer to wash it all down, a little homebrew, lots of cheap stuff in cans. We debrief about trips taken or not taken, too much work, too little, a good garden harvest, a bad fishing year, the biggest tomato of the summer. The party is chatty and laughing. No one comes to stand quietly. Last year, as usual, it rained. Bonfire, giant tarp, layers zipped up to our chins. Just before it grew dark and the rain lifted enough to allow the day's clearest shaft of unfiltered sun, cranes streamed from the west and filled the sky with their chorused uproar. The party went still. Together we watched. Susan and David, who have lived here for more than 25 years, our 6-year-old friend Jake, someone's parents on the first night of a visit from Wisconsin, all of our faces uplifted. I can't remember the last time I was outdoors with 30 silent people. The nightening sky was so noisy with cranes we could hardly have heard each other if we spoke anyway. I wondered about my clustered friends and neighbors, chins tipped upward as if receiving a blessing, though the cranes were their own world, too intent on survival and travel to bother with dispensing grace. Is everyone thinking what I am, looking to the sky that spans our homes? This is what I'm thinking. Of course the cranes are here. They are our neighbors, too. The second section is called Things I've Learned About Cranes, and I learned a lot of things about cranes, but I'm just going to read two. To describe a crane's call, any one of them, pushes the limits of language and metaphor. The sound is nearly impossible to describe, thumbnail dragged along a taut piano string, friction causing stops and starts. Nothing I write will help you hear it exactly. The hum of a small plane's engine heard from behind the next ridge and the pilot singing loud. I sit at my desk trying, an old-fashioned wooden ratchet noisemaker at soccer games, mining the seams of my experience, a ski pole tip plunged into hard-packed single-digit snow, but nothing feels exactly right. Children shouting on the playground, one odd voice above the rest, the creak of an old seesaw in the background, and suddenly my mouth and throat open, and I am croaking and warbling at my desk instead. That which cannot be described by the mind tries to lodge itself in a body. Sound is not a sentence you quietly read. It requires a living world and presence. Mind to hear the sound, the cranes to make the sound. Listen. The Athabascan word for crane is dildula, after the onomatopoeia of their song, and the word for cranberry is dildula baba, meaning crane's food. English echoes this trajectory with the word origin cranebere from Low Germanic, named because the flower, petal, and stem of the berry plant looked like the head and neck and bill of a crane. The omnivorous sandhill eats cranberries along with every other tundra plant on the menu, and the proteiny burst of insects, even a vole if it can catch one. Cranes are opportunivores who dig and plunge and strike and nibble, feeding on what's near. I love the way language invites polarities onto a tongue. A word connects the eater and the eaten. A berry connects the Athabascan and the European. A bird connects a berry to a mother tongue. Cranberry and crane's call are woven in with boggy sphagnum, the wetland that supports them both, where one grows and the other feeds. These are my autumn treasures, a taste and a sound bound up in a stew of wetness and coming cold. The bustle of motion, fly, pick, and the promise of winter's stillness to come. So then I have a section about wetlands in the Denali area, and I learned a ton of fascinating stuff, which I really wish I had time to talk about more, but I'm gonna skip over some of that and move to some of the connections that I'm making as I'm thinking about birds and ponds and puddles and all of us living in the region. The contemporary Earth is huge and far-flung, but it is also tightly bound. We know that water ties distant places to each other, something we learned in grade school. Remember the lessons about water as the vascular system of the world? And revisit as adults with phrases like, we all live downstream. Precipitation in one bioregion becomes runoff in another. One latitude's ocean currents influence another's snowfall. Cranes connect ecosystems too in a tangible way. The air and water that flows between us is mostly invisible and aggregate, but cranes are distinct, trackable, visible, and audible. They come to our place from someone else's, and they return there again, announcing their arrival and departure. They affect and are affected by places we never see. In addition to the purely aesthetic spectacle of those flocks and the biological wonder, they also do the metaphoric work of connection. Cranes are ambassadors for otherness. They help us imagine beyond our own borders and to beckon what is far off closer in. As the noted Oregon poet William Stafford wrote in a poem about cranes, they reach for the land. They stalk the plowed fields, not letting us near, not quite our own, not quite the world's. People go by and pull over to watch. They peer and point and wonder. It is because these travelers, these far wanderers, plane down and yearn in a reaching flight. They extend our life, piercing through space to reappear, quietly, undeniably, where we are. The last section is called Neighbors Again. Animals know how to use what the world offers. I have always loved how suited creatures are to their habitats, to a level of survival that includes a core of thrive. I admire a wolf's coat, water resistant and warm, comfortable in temperatures from 80 above to 40 below, while I change in and out of 10 layers from season to season. I notice how a wood frog's spotted skin conceals it among last year's dead aspen leaves floating at the edge of the pond where it breeds, how its blood enables it to freeze solid in winter and thaw when it is safe to be cold-blooded and thin-skinned. I covet a snow owl's furry feet. I marvel at how a bear sow's body delays egg implantation until it has enough fat stores to grow a fetus. When I watched the cranes fly southeast last fall, my unspoken admiration took a further step. A fully worded question sprang to my mind as I looked at the sky, and it recurred to me every time I heard them. What must it be like to find the world sufficient? I've asked it again and again in the months since, a quan I must be meant to worry at until it produces a sharp stab of insight. One of the greatest tragedies of climate change, one we can never explain to animals, is that we are shaping a world that will be unable to provide for some creatures. At its simplest, that's how extinction happens. The world, sometimes distanced as a resource, becomes not enough or too much. We have recently begun to realize that we are vulnerable to the same fate. Like most species, humans will likely not be around forever. We are animals, and though our ingenuity and our plastics and desalinated ocean water and flights to the moon occasionally convince us that we do not evolve or exist within limits, at some point, if the world becomes insufficient, then we too will diminish and die out. I am unused to true scarcity, the kind that triggers thoughts of extinction. Even though my lifestyle, like others I know, dances the edges of self-sufficiency, eating within the season's dictates, living off the grid, harvesting wood and sun for fuel, Still, I rarely confront the limits of true need. A lean berry year is softened by the remainders of last year's epic bounty, ziplocked in the chest freezer. An overcast month means we buy more gas for the generator. In a summer where we don't bring in enough salmon, friends offer fillets and we eat less fish and more of something else. For most of us, me included, scarcity means there are no ripe avocados at the grocery store. I'd guess that only when we have to confront the stark reality of not enough, the hunger or thirst the developing world knows but which we consign to apocalyptic novels, then will we truly grasp what it means that we are animals. When the world is suddenly or slowly unable to provide, and we realize that it is all we have ever had. It's water that puts me in this animal place. Groundwater on the Esker top I call home lies hundreds of feet deep. In lieu of an expensive private well, we haul water from a community spigot and supplement it with rain catchment barrels. 50-gallon drums sit under every eave, providing water for dogs and plants, dishes and showers, and any cooking that requires boiling. In a dry spell, I watch the water levels in the barrel drop with each watering can or solar shower. Even though our well is just down the gravel road, I imagine, if these barrels were all we had, I would be frightened. My own little wetland drying up, the moisture in my skin, my mouth, palpable and temporary. When I have nightmares about climate change, they are dry-mouthed ones. While I value their symbolism and the way they prod my shadow mind, I do not believe that nightmares are a place to rest. I know the shrunken ponds and waning birds and two warm weeks in July and in January, the polar bears drowning and the village is falling into the sea. I can't turn away from these realities and the injustices they prefigure. To do so is to fail. But it is possible in these times to become afraid of the world, and in the face of that fear, to become numb to the world. There is no more point in living in a state of fear, or for that matter, elegy, while we are still alive and thriving, than there would be in mourning a person we love before she is gone. When I wake from a dream of thirst, I get a drink, and then I throw myself into the day, where there is plenty to worry about, but far more to do. There is work on behalf of birds, counting, banding, leaving one cranberry on every bush. Work to use less water so that more can remain on the surface of the world. Work to replace the words less and scarce with the word enough. Work to notice, to watch. In my neighborhood, we talk about what we're watching. I heard the great horned owl's mating call in the aspen grove last week in April. I haven't seen a whimbrel at Eight Mile Lake in years. There used to be long-tailed jaggers everywhere, and now there aren't. Do the wood frogs seem quieter to you this year? Such conversation connects us and yields animated discussions. We're interested in what others see and hear. We want, in the way of most neighborhoods, to keep tabs on the goings-on. This confirms the truth of the linguistic link between watching and vigor. Watch comes from the old English word waken, which means to be awake, and the Proto-German wachen, which means to be strong, lively. Strong and lively reminds me of the personality of cranes, and so the circle goes. Watch and work merge with dance and warble. Migrations of birds connect with neighbors staying put. Amidst the shifting ground of climate and projection, worst-case scenario and high hopes, the repeated circling question the cranes trigger in me is the only place I have to stand, trying to be brave enough to ask, what would enough be like? Letting the mantra pulse beneath all ordinary days, what the world offers is sufficient. I picture the pure effort of those cranes launching themselves from a soggy patch of cotton grass into an easterly wind, allowing a thermal to lift their bodies, each the size of a small child. I hear their throaty gargle, and in it a simple belief in the future, in the existence of wherever they are going next. Of course, because I cannot describe the motions or the sound, my body takes over, and as I write this, my arms want to spread to show how wide the wings, how high the loft, and my throat wants to open, to give noise to how rowdy and exquisite the call. Thank you. I believe this is where any change will originate. Any hope from our animal bodies, from hunger and thirst and the pleasure of eating and drinking, from limbs flapping and legs kicked out, movement expressing a joy in the world that cannot be contained, from shouts and laughter, warning and song, the indescribable alchemy of effort and the release that trust in the present can bring. All of us together here, trying to find our way. Thanks.